Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes with The Bite Show. And tonight we have Douglas Riggs and Dr. Preston Bailey. And they are going to enlarge upon the parahumanism that we did the last time. So, okay, Douglas, fire away.
Well, thank you again, Georgianne, for this opportunity that you've given to myself and Preston. It's great to have Preston back with us.
Yes.
Our last discussion, we were talking about parahumanism and, of course, the whole reoccurrence of the phenomenon that we see in Genesis 6, 1 through 4,
mm-hmm.
And how that is impacting our generation. And we talked about how that fits in the context of generational ritual abuse. And so we had two extended sessions on that. And I thought tonight we could enlarge more on the biblical framework, some scriptures that would bring to bear the relevancy of what we're dealing with, and hopefully just through spending time in the Word and, of course, incorporating, you know, any other issues that Preston feels like we need to cover, we could do that. So, Preston, it's been several weeks since we were on. Is there anything been going on with you as a result of our last interview? Any emails, contacts, anything going on that's on your mind before we kick this off?
Yes, at the beginning, let me just again define what a parahuman is. A parahuman is very simply a human-animal hybrid. Some people think that that is not possible, but that is not, according to scientific research. Para means alongside of, like a parachute,
yeah,
or a paramedic is alongside of a doctor, a medical staff. So a parahuman is a hybrid of a human and animal. And this research has been done different places in the world, and even in China, where they don't have the restrictions they have here. There is there's parahuman research, and so people who think that this is not possible is not correct. And some people may have heard, even from science fiction movies, about Chimera, which is an animal that has two or more different populations of genetically distinct cells within it. And this has already occurred. So there's a number of chimera animals in existence. So people who say that this can not genetically occur just does not happen. I've talked to a number of people since the last time we were on air, and a friend in Australia, John, was telling me some of the people he has talked to that talked about being attacked by a Nephilim. So there's people who are describing these events all over the world, and the Christian community needs to start taking these things seriously. And I believe the Bible has an explanation for all of these events. And as we have said before, the Bible says in Matthew, which every Christian concerned with the last days knows this verse, as in the days of Noah, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. So tonight we're going to discuss other verses in the Bible that may even go into more detail about hybrids or Nephilim or creatures that are mentioned in the Bible?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, parahumanism, I think Tom Horn uses the phrase transhumanism, also transgenetics, as another way to see this. You know, it's one thing to see how the that species barrier has been crossed against God's will. We know that in Genesis 1, he created each of the animals according to their kind. And so there is a barrier. And so to cross that barrier is definitely against the created will of God. And that's what our enemy is doing. This is a criminal act on his part. And I think it's not only important for us to see that, you know, the military is, of course, I'd say militaries around the world are competing to create enhanced super soldiers through the genetic engineering. But I think the ultimate conspiracy is we see in Genesis 6, the attack was upon the seed of the woman. And so in that particular situation, it's not just an animal. We have a fallen angels, 200 according to the first book of Enoch, and they were able to cross that species barrier to mate with human women and produce a hybrid offspring for the specific purpose of corrupting the seed of the woman, Genesis 3:15, so there would not be a human capable of becoming man's redeemer. And I think that's the real focus today. And of course, people talk about the reverse engineering and working back towards that which would be a Nephilim gene of some type. But why would you need to do reverse engineering when we have clear reports that women, again, in since 1949, at least in what people I've worked with, Preston, is that they are reporting direct sexual contact with Satan, which was never reported that I know of in all of history, in producing a hybrid offspring. So, you know, we live in a very unique generation. This generation is the first generation in recorded history where Satan himself is now reported as producing a Nephilim offspring. So that ramps up the whole category of spiritual warfare to a new level, and I believe is that what we're seeing is the Luciferian endgame and in preparation for bringing in that final army, the armies of Antichrist that we see in Revelation 16 gathered together for the great war of God Almighty, and then we see in Revelation 19:19 to literally wage war with the returning Christ with a goal to defeat God and to wipe him out. So I think that's kind of a summary, but I think that's some of the focus that we talked about last time. So you know, I brought this in you know, this particular emphasis, Preston, because we're not talking about the mixture of animals and humans, but we're talking about the actual hybridization as a result of the crossbreeding with fallen angels, in this case Satan, and women. Do you have any thoughts or comments on that?
Yes. There is, this has been, like you said, since 1949, this has been reported by most what I call high cult Satanists. They even tell an annual ritual in which Satan has sex with humans. It's called the Feast of the Beast. The beast is Satan, and we know it's described in the book of Revelation as the beast. For a number of years, satanic cult groups were trying to compete to come up with an offspring that would produce the Antichrist. But now they have Satan has come up with these hybrid entities of fallen angels and humans, and like you said, they're going to compose the army of the Fourth Reich. Anybody who denies that the Fourth Reich is real and needs to study Nazi Germany, especially at the close of World War II in Germany, they were already starting plans for the Fourth Reich and their takeover of the world. So people need to do a little history research to find that many of these things that we say are historically facts.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. In fact, there are some, Joseph Farrell and his books, The Nazi Internationale, Roswell and the Fourth Reich, of course, Jim Marr's book on the rise of the Fourth Reich. Dr. Dennis Cuddy has done a whole series on News with Views on the very thing you're talking about, and how the planning stages beginning as early as 1943, especially around Himmler and his castle, that they saw they were going to lose the war. And of course, Himmler was ahead of the whole SS and very much occultically involved there at his castle, their vessel. I forgot how they pronounce it, but they were already in the planning stages to perpetuate that which was referred to as the Third Reich. And they actually said that when they would reemerge within two generations, it would be called the European Union. This was in 1943. And it's important for historians that the very first Bilderberg meeting, I believe it was there in 53 or 54, at the Bilderberg structure, but it was all to bring into realization the European Union, and that, of course, has been in progress for some time, and it's well advanced. And of course, I've worked with people that were there. There were massive rituals that were going on to power up all that which would represent the implementation of this as a global agenda, all in preparation for bringing in Antichrist. So, you're absolutely correct, There's good resources, which I just mentioned, where people, if they want to dig into this more, there is solid historical works that have been done on this that clearly define historically where we are in history.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that.
Let's. I would like to just, for those that may not fully understand what is taking place today. You'd mentioned, Preston, that as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be at the return of the Son of Man. And, of course, he talks about marrying and giving in marriage. Well, that was, of course, human, but there were other marriages that were taking place that were more than just the average marriage. And I just want to go back to that Genesis passage and then move into the New Testament and really dig in to the text, so that people can see, what we're dealing with, because this is the very heart of the mystery of iniquity. You know, Paul says in Second Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 7, he says, "For the mystery of iniquity is now working." That is, mystery being is secret; it is hidden; it cannot be known except by revelation. And he says, it is now working, the energeia there, energeo, means it's supernaturally operational, but it's hidden. And so when people ask, well, where are these Nephilim today? Show me the goods. I want evidence. If it's a mystery and it's hidden, you're not going to see it until the proper time of disclosure. And so it's begging the question, and it's really demonstrating ignorance of the very fact that Satan must keep this hidden until, of course, the restrainer is removed. And I believe the restrainer is the person and presence of the Holy Spirit in the church, restraining the ultimate, the final revelation and parousia, or the coming of the man of sin. But going back to Genesis 6, I'm just going to read through this and just then move over into the New Testament commentary. And then I'm going to break at intervals and let you comment in any way you see fit, Preston. So I'm going to just pick up in Genesis 6. Now, it came about when men, and the Hebrew there is Adam, this would be those of the descendants of Adam, began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them. So we know these daughters are also daughters of Adam. These are not bloodline. These are just human beings as descendants of Adam. That the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. Now, it's important that this particular term, sons of God, this is not referring to the line of Seth. This refers to beings they are of a specific creation of God. Like if we look at the genealogy in Luke chapter 3, we trace it all the way back to Adam, who is called a son of God. So when we follow the genealogy in Luke all the way back to Adam, why is he called a son of God? Because he was a direct creation of God. And so it's the same way here. So this cannot be a reference to Seth, because the Sethites were not a direct creation of God. They are also descendants of Adam. So the B'nai HaElohim, that particular Hebrew structure only occurs, to my understanding, five times in the Hebrew Bible. It occurs here in verse 2. It also occurs again in verse 4. And it occurs three times in the book of Job. Now, it's interesting that chronologically, the book of Job is, according to scholars, the oldest book in the Bible. In other words, it deals with a man's life, Job, that was probably a contemporary of Abraham, or one of the, or perhaps Isaac, we don't know, but one of the patriarchs. And if we go over to the book of Job, which I'm just going to turn there for a quick reference, and see how this exact same term is used in the book of Job. And so we see this introduction in the book of Job. And, of course, Job is very prosperous. And it says that in verse 5 of Job 1, it came about when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, that Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning, offering burnt offerings. We know that that's there was no Levitical priesthood at this time. And in verse 6, it says, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, Satan also among them. And the Lord said to Satan. So here we see the B'nai HaElohim as a part of that angelic entourage that came before God, that came before the Lord. We see the same phrase in Job chapter 2, verse 1. The sons of God are used there, again referring to angels accompanying Satan. And if you turn to Job 38, we see the final reference, where at the creation, we see that prior to the creation of the world, angels were already created. And we see in Job 38, he says there that with reference to the creation, that God is asking Job a question. Of course, he asked Job many questions regarding his desire to have an interview with God. Job 38:4 says, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurement, since you know? Or who stretched the line upon it? And on what were its bases sunk? And who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Again, the B'nai HaElohim. So it is clear from these references that this specific term, the B'nai HaElohim, that is a definite article that is used in front of Elohim plural there. And one of the Septuagint manuscripts, it is actually translated angels of God. But going back to that passage in in Genesis 6. I'll just turn to there again. And so we see the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that is the daughters of Adam. They were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. I think it was noted in our previous time together that until, in my knowledge, it was not until 2002 that they were able to produce, they were able to have it's called the Genesis 6 Project, and one of the young women I'm working with is just 21, were they able to take a non-bloodline and actually, through the various rituals and the preparations and the work that they did in her life, was to make it possible for her to conceive and give birth to Nephilim. And so here we have this incident here in Genesis 6, where it was whomever they choose. They took wives whomever they choose. And then we see the Lord said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he is also flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years." And so there's a certain time limit that God is going to place upon the human race before final judgment comes. Now, and then he says, the Nephilim, the fallen ones, were on the earth in those days and also afterward. And there are some that say the frequency use of the conjunction there, Vav, could be translated differently. But all the translations that are acceptable that we have today, it has afterward. So we know that there was a second and more confined eruption during the time of the Israelites' occupation of the land of Canaan, as we see in Numbers 13, verse 33. So we see that in those days, the days of Noah, also afterward, that is, after the flood, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, that's a euphemism for sexual intercourse. They came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the Hagivarim, the mighty men, the champions, the heroes, who were of old, men of renown or great reputation. Now, when we look at this passage, it's important that when we come to the New Testament, how did the Jewish interpreters of the time of our Lord, this includes Josephus understood this reference here to be the angels and not to the line of Seth. That was an idea or a concept that was introduced during the time of Augustine or Augustine. But prior to that, the early church fathers, the Jewish rabbis, there was only one view, and that was the supernatural view that these B'nai Elohim, the sons of God, referred to angels, and in this case, fallen angels. Now, when we come to the New Testament commentary on this, it's very important. And I want to begin with Jude. Well, maybe I'll just begin with 2 Peter, because it's brief. 2 Peter is talking about the judgment upon false prophets. And so if God judge angels for their sin, then what's going to happen to these false teachers that are in the church and leading people astray? So I'm going to pick up 2 Peter 2:4. For if God did not spare angels, the implication is he's not going to spare these false teachers that have come in and infiltrated the church in the last days. So 2 Peter 2:4, if God did not spare angels when they sinned. Now, many people look at this and they say, oh, well, this is when Satan rebelled and he was thrown out of heaven prior to the creation of man. This is impossible, because this is a specific group of angels that are in prison. We know Satan. We know in Luke chapter 8, when Jesus was confronting the demoniacs, they begged him, do not send us into the abyss. And the abyss, according to many scholars, is a synonym for Tartarus. And so here we have these demons begging Jesus not to send them into the abyss. So we know just from that very statement in Luke 8 that this in no way can refer to the original fall of Satan. So this is a specific group of angels that sin. Now notice, if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell, it's actually a verb, tartarao, he tartarized them. That is, he cast them into this place where the Greek titans, rebellious gods, were sent, and it's a place that is defined below Hades, deep in the earth, He cast them into Tartarus, and he committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and he did not spare the ancient world but preserved Noah. So right there, the very context refers back to Genesis 6. And so that is where we will, now we can turn to Jude 6. But before I do that, I've been going on for quite some time, but I want to get right into the text of Jude 6, and then eventually, you know, as we are given time, to go to Daniel chapter 2 and look at some of those passages there. But do you have any thoughts or any comments? If so, take your liberty.
While you were speaking, I was reading the actual Hebrew text and following along with you, and because I know Hebrew and Greek, and the what you said was a literal translation from the Hebrew text. Let me also add, because many lay people are confused about that, in Matthew 24, where it says, as in the days of Noah, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. It says, angels neither marry nor are given in marriage. It doesn't say they don't have sex. It says they don't marry. So angels don't marry. I would agree with that statement. But that doesn't prohibit them from having sex. And as I said, anybody who has studied Satanism knows that even there's a whole class of demons, incubus and succubus, that have sex. So anyone who says that demons don't have sex do not know human history very well.
Yes.
It doesn't, like I said, it angels don't marry or given in marriage. But everything you said in the book of Job is correct. Every one of those texts, like I said, I was reading along in Hebrew, and it says, Bini Ha Elohim, which is the sons of God. And consistently in the Old Testament, the phrase sons of God refers to angels. It doesn't refer to the descendants of Seth or anyone else. Otherwise, it would be very significant to be repeated over and over again if it was just descendants. And in the there's even the book of Numbers, in which descendants are mentioned in detail, which gets very, very boring. So they describe it in detail. So I think that there is little doubt that the sons of God refers to angelic. I just refer to them as angelic beings, because there's many different orders of angels.
Yes. Yeah, and I think, too, when we come to the New Testament, through the new birth, we become sons of God. That's a direct new creation act of God. In other words, there's no ancestry to that. And so if we say a son of God, it refers to a direct creation. Even to who we are as born-again Christians, it is a direct creation of God, but we call that the new birth. And so the very term that is used with reference to the believers in the New Testament, you don't really find that in the Old Testament in terms of that which defines a relationship between the covenant people of Israel and God. That's a uniquely a New Testament term. So this terminology in the Old Testament is uniquely designating the angelic beings, as you mentioned. But I want to comment on the Matthew 22:30. It says, you know, they were describing who's, you know, the Jews were trying, the Sadducees were trying to catch Jesus in a question about if a brother, he dies and marries another wife, you know, who is he going to belong to in the resurrection? And Jesus says, Jesus answered and said to them, "You are mistaken, not understanding the scriptures or the power of God." And then in Matthew 22:30, "For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels in heaven." Now, when he says like the angels in heaven, that excludes, by definition, those who are referred to in Genesis 6. It says they took wives. They took wives. So the issue isn't that angels can't marry. It's just that the angels in heaven don't marry. But the point is that those in Genesis 6, they left heaven. They gave up their proper abode. And that's where I want to turn to Jude 6, because when we look at this passage in Jude 6, that helps us understand that this is the complete antithesis of what Jesus was referring to in Matthew 22, verse 30. So I want to just read this passage, and then I have a very excellent commentary here. Dr. D. Edmund Hebert, who is now with the Lord, he's a Bible commentary. He's a professor of Greek New Testament for many years at Mennonite Brethren Biblical Seminary in Fresno. And Dr. Hebert, H-I-E-B-E-R-T, has written several commentaries, including the 2 Thessalonians and 1 Peter. And the one I have in front of me here is 2 Peter and Jude. And he's one of the most exhaustive in terms of really being detailed. And so I'm going to read the passage and just give a few comments by Dr. Hebert, then I'll break off. And then, Preston, you can comment in any way you see fit. But in the contrast here is the children of Israel to unbelief. They were destroyed. That is, they died the sin unto death in the wilderness. That's the context of Jude chapter 5. So if God destroyed those who did not believe in the wilderness, then he moves on to a higher category of being, that is verse 6, and angels who did not keep, that is, tereo, they did not guard, aorist tense, their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode. He has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Now, this is an amazing statement. The judgment of the great day, this refers, if you go to Revelation chapter 6, verse 17, we see that the time of the Daniel 70th week, or the day of the Lord, is referred to there as the wrath of the Lamb, verse 16. For the great day of their wrath has come. It's called the great day of their wrath. This is a time of judgment. This is also found in Revelation 16, where the reference is to a time of God's great wrath. And in verse 14, we see that gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. So these angels are kept for that great day in judgment. Eternal bonds means they're never going to get out of that judgment. But I believe they're going to be released for a period of time as instruments of judgment in the tribulation we see in Revelation 9. But getting back to this verse, there's two things here that we have to really make sure we get a hold of. These angels did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode. He has kept eternal bonds for judgment. In other words, these angels were, as we see from 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, were imprisoned. We know that Ephesians 6:12, that Satan and those that are with him are not imprisoned. Satan goes about as a roaring lion, seeking those whom he may devour. Now, I want to pick up in Dr. Hebert's book. I'm just going to read from his commentary. It says, the angels, they left their habitation, their own. The personal pronoun points to their own distinctive possession assigned to them by God. So we see in Matthew 22, verse 30, the angels in heaven, they are the elect. They are not of this category who did not guard their proper habitation or domain. And so we see that this pronoun here points to that which was their own distinctive possession, assigned to them by God. The noun signifies what is first and primary. That is, they did not keep their own arche, that which is primary, first or primary in time or in rank. The reference may be to first estate, their own original state. And so it may refer to, if you look at some of the ways that this is translated, the King James, the word for arche, is they did not guard their first estate, or as Darby translates it, their own original state, or as the New Century Bible, their appointed sphere, or their first domain, as Montgomery translates it, or Moffat, their original rank, or Williams, the dominion given to them, and the New English Bible, their own principality, etc., their position of authority. So we see that the angelic beings were assigned a particular place, but they abandoned that in Genesis 6. That is the whole point. So they left their assigned a position of authority that was assigned them by God, and their own original state in which God placed them at creation, and not satisfied, Dr. Hebert says, with the position or sphere which they held, they abandon it. Or the term may indicate their appointed position of preeminence from which they exercised rule and authority. And then he goes on to say the view that the reference is to their position of dignity and authority seems to be based on the Septuagint translation of Deuteronomy 32:8, where they these angelic hosts were assigned different races according to the angelic host. So it intimates that the angels were given a dominion over earthly creatures, according to the Septuagint translation of Deuteronomy 32:8. Now, clearly the term points to the exalted status of these angelic beings, a status which they failed to maintain. And Dr. Hebert continues, positively these angels sinned in that they left their proper habitation. Then the next verse, but a strong contrast marks the contrast between what they did not do and what they did do, although the reference is in the same direction. It refers to the same action. The preceding negative declaration looks back to their exalted position, which they failed to maintain. The positive designation of their sin points to the lower status to which they deliberately descended. Now, that's so that, one, they did not keep their original assigned sphere of authority or rule, but they left their proper habitation. This is a second reference, records what these angels did. It says they left, that is, this particular Greek term speaks of their deliberate abandonment of their proper place to invade another sphere. That is, something happened. There was some transformation that occurred. They didn't keep their place in heaven, so they're not the angels of heaven anymore. They took on some type of supernatural, spiritual, genetic manipulation. They took on a form of physicality so they could actually mate with women and produce offspring. And that's my commentary. Barnes notes that the statement implies that they became dissatisfied with their abode and voluntarily preferred to change it for another. Their proper habitation, oiketerion, is habitation, indicates the dwelling place was their personal and distinctive God-assigned abode. The place was in keeping with their nature and assignment. It is generally assumed that it was located in heaven. Now, this word only occurs, this term, oiketerion, only occurs in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 2, and it refers to the future heavenly bodies of the resurrected saints. We don't have that habitation, that house in heaven. So the same term is used there for the future heavenly bodies of resurrected saints. So think about this. If whatever spiritual bodies they had, perhaps they were light bodies, it would be my guess, if they left that their sphere of rule and they took on some type of physicality, then Jude is describing the exact same event that occurred in Genesis 6. So I'm going to stop right there before I proceed, because there is there's more that I want to read from Dr. Hebert, but I want to, any thoughts or comments, Preston, at this point?
What I find interesting is the word you read is Tartarus in Greek, but it's originally a Latin word, and it really describes the primeval deities or the giants who were in Greek mythology, who were supposed to be the first children of the earth and even older than the Greek gods. They were cast out when they lost their war with Zeus. And we see the battle in oftentimes mythology, ancient Roman and Greek mythology, is really describing in the demonic spiritual realm battles that are taking place. And what's interesting is in Greek mythology and Roman mythology, the children of the Greek or Roman gods, when they had sex with human women, their children were called demigods. And it's interesting that here in Genesis 6, there is the battle of the sons of God. The fallen angels came unto the human women and had offspring. And in Greek and Latin mythology, it tells the same thing. And like I said, many times stories passed from generation are based on truth, which is historical based mythology. And so this is the battle of Tartarus and the ancient story of the Greek and Roman gods and their demigods, which are their children.
Yeah. And I think, of course, these stories are recorded all over the world. We see it in the Mayan cultures. We see it in the Sumerian culture, the Anakim, and the various, I think, all the records throughout history. I think Steve Quayle has a book called The Genesis 6, The Giants, where he traces this this mythos, if you will, of the various the records of all world civilizations have some account of that which can be traced back to Genesis 6. And so that's very important, even though we don't look at that as canon. The point is that these accounts of that which is defined for us in the biblical record can be traced through the various civilizations and their legends. Going back to this particular passage, we see the angels did not keep their own domain, their own arche, their assigned sphere of rule, of position and authority, but they abandoned their proper abode. And that very well may include the kind of body that was assigned to them at creation, according to the very term as it is used in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 2. God has kept. It's interesting, in the Greek text, it's put at the end, it's emphatic. It's kind of a play on words. They did not keep their own domain, so God has kept, with double emphasis, in eternal bonds under the darkness for the judgment of the great day. And I'm going to pick up and just read on of Dr. Hebert. He says there are two main, he goes on, he says, There are two main views concerning the identity of these angels. One finds here a reference to the original fall of angels who defected with Satan, which we know that's impossible, because Satan is not in prison. But he goes on to say, others hold that Jude's example refers to an extraordinary event recounted in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Their sin, that is, these angels referred to in Jude 6, 2 Peter 2, 4, and in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, this is what he's referring to. Their sin would refer to a special sexual perversion aimed at corrupting the human race. Again, attack upon the seed of the woman, Genesis 3:15. The former explanation, that is, that this refers to the original fall of Satan and his angels, does not do justice to the picture that follows of the judgment of God upon these angels. The next verse seems to imply the latter interpretation, and it agrees with the views of Judaism and the early Christian church. God's judgment upon these angels comes out with vivid precision. He hath kept in everlasting bonds under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. And then the original places the verb emphatically at the end for emphasis. And, of course, that verb that he has kept is perfect tense, emphasizing that which took place in the past, but that judgment is still in place. They're still kept there. And then reading on, being kept under strict confinement, these angels can look forward only to the dread future day when they will be cast into the lake of fire prepared for the devil and his angels, Matthew 25:41. Because they had failed to keep the station and the function assigned to them by God, he is now keeping them under punishment. The angels are now confined in everlasting bonds under darkness. Their present fettering is only temporal, looking forward to a final judgment. And I believe that judgment would include that's their ultimate destiny. But according to Revelation 9, that these entities very well will be the ones that are released to be used by God. If man doesn't want to worship God, they want to worship demons, then God's going to let mankind have full force what that means, and it'll be horrific. So there's no prospect of restoration awaits them. Their fall is final because they are bound. These angels must be distinguished from other fallen angels who are now unbound and active against mankind. As I mentioned earlier, Luke 8:31, Romans 8:38, Colossians 2:15, and Ephesians 6:12. Now, you know, well, people will often quote Jude 6, but they miss the reference to Jude 7, because Jude 7 sheds so much light on the nature of the sin, the specificity of the sin of the angels in Genesis 6. So notice how Jude 7 begins. Just as we have a comparison. In other words, the angels who sinned in Genesis 6 is compared to the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah. And Jude 7 gives us the comparison. So just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they, they, in the same way as these, indulged in gross immorality, and since they, that is the inhabitants of Sodom, in the same way as these, this pronoun, by its masculine construction, refers back to the masculine angels in verse 6. So the sin of homosexuality in Sodom and Gomorrah is compared to that which is so outside of divine order. It says it's in the same way as these, referring to the angels in Genesis 6, indulged in gross immorality. This term here is only used in the New Testament. It's not the word pornuomai, to fornicate. It's ekpornuomai, which is an intensified. It means they utterly gave themselves over to fornication. So what is this? What is the sin? It is the sin of the angels. Is they gave themselves over to that which is beyond that which would be just defined as fornication. It was an amplified, if you will, form whereby angels cohabiting with women. And then we see that, and this is Hebert again, he says the term ek in front of the verb seems to give intensive force, indicating an out-and-out surrender to extravagant sexual lust. Hebert goes on to say, Big asserts that the preposition may add the notion of going outside the moral law. And they went after. It says the compound expression gone after indicates the departure from the established order in nature to follow a practice contrary to nature. And they went after strange flesh. In Sodom and Gomorrah, men with men. That's strange. That is heteros. That is flesh of a category that is abnormal, like we see in Romans chapter 1. They went after strange flesh. And here it clearly denotes that which is different from the established order. And so when angels cohabit with women, that is outside the established order. And so here we see the sin of angels, in Genesis 6, is a gross form of fornication. So the text is clear, and I wanted to cover that this time, Preston, because when we come to the New Testament commentary on what took place in Genesis 6, it's very clear, and it doesn't leave a lot of margin for guesswork. So I've taken quite a bit of time on this, but I wanted to really focus on this and make sure that our listeners really understood these New Testament references in the context of, in the light of, and being interpretation for what took place in Genesis 6. So you just take it away from there and comment any way you choose, Preston.
Yes, let me add just a few things here. It says in the verse there in Jude, as you pointed out, just as, using in Greek, it uses the word as or like. A simile is using as or like, which is a comparison of two similar things. So the first word used there in Greek refers to this as a simile. It says in a similar way. In the New International Version, it clarifies it even in detail in a similar way. A similar way means a simile. A simile is the comparison of two similar things. So the angels who kept not their first estate, their first position of authority, the place that they should have resided in heaven, they didn't keep that position. They didn't stay submitted to the God of heaven. They rebelled against that first position. And here, in Sodom and Gomorrah, of course we know sodomy is unnatural, sex act, and it was an unnatural sex act between fallen angels and human women. It is very clear that these are two similar unnatural sex acts that was committed. And God has created a natural order in the universe. Every angel of heaven, every angelic being, has a specific function in the heavenly hierarchy. And these angels that kept not their first estate, they didn't keep what God had ordained that they walked in. They rebelled against God. And they did, which was unnatural, in fornicating, ex-fornicate, a very intense type of immoral behavior that they did this. So it's anyone who says that angels don't have a natural sex with women. They're not reading the Bible literally in its original language. Wouldn't you agree with that, Doug?
Oh, yes. And that's why I wanted to read the comparison there in verse 7, because verse 7 actually nails down the actual sin of the angels in Genesis 6 by making a comparison to the unnatural sexual act of that which characterized Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yes, that's definitely the case. So we see in the book of Revelation the pit of the abyss is opened, and these even evil fallen creatures that are described in a hideous manner in the book of Revelation is released onto the earth, and people beg to die. It is so violent and so evil. That's just another side of these hybrid evil entities.
Yes, I think, too, the very term abusos there, when the demon says, do not send us into the abusos, that, I believe that is just another term for Tartarus. It's just two different ways to define it. So if abusos or Tartarus is opened up, then these entities that are in prison, they're still under judgment, but they're going to be used by God in the end, as we see in the end of Revelation chapter 6, because they did not repent of their sorceries and their idolatries and their fornications. This is why the judgment is coming upon them, because they do not repent. So it's basically like this. Okay, you, mankind, you don't want to worship the true and living God. You want to worship demons. I'm going to give you a full dose. I'm going to give you what it means where there is no restraint, and it will be an overwhelming judgment upon them. It's the same way you look at their Revelation 16. One of the judgments is they pour out the vial onto the sun, and the sun is heated seven times hotter. Well, the sun is an object of worship. You know, the Nazi swastika is a symbol of the sun and of the power of creation. It's an occult symbol. So you want to worship the Nazi symbol? You want to worship the sun? You want to worship Apollo? And this is the sun deity is found throughout all pagan cultures. Okay, you want to worship the sun? A judgment is poured up on the sun. It's heated seven times hotter, so people are blistered. So this is the gravity of the judgment that's coming upon mankind for rebellion and for idolatry. And so when we look at the sin of what God did, not the sin, but the sins of what the angels committed and what happened to them, it is a warning. It is a warning to mankind that God is not only a God of love and grace who brings salvation, but there is a certain point where his patience runs out. And I will only remind people that three times in the book of Jeremiah, and I can give people the references, I think 11, 12, 13, or 14, Jeremiah prays, and God told Jeremiah on three occasions, do not pray for this people. I will not listen to you any longer. They had passed the threshold of opportunity that God had given them to repent. And so this is very serious, and we have a maudlin mindset today about God. We do not fear the Lord, and yes, he is a God of love and mercy, and the very fact that we still exist as a nation today, when we should have been, we deserve to be wiped out for over 50 million plus infants that have been slaughtered, infanticide plus every other kind of perversion, that's proof that God is a God of mercy. But there's going to come a time when the judgment will fall, and it will be, they will be terrified.
Yes, and it was so serious to God when the sons of God, the angels, came unto the women and had physical offspring, that God caused a flood to wipe out mankind except for the family of Noah.
Yes.
And most civilizations around the world record a flood narrative. You can't help but look at the Grand Canyon in places out west here in the United States. They are sedimentary rock, and see the results of the worldwide flood. So just like I believe there was a worldwide flood, in the same way, I believe that these fallen angels came unto the daughters of men and had offspring. And it was so vile and so wicked, like you said, that God wiped them out with a worldwide flood to prevent their DNA from being passed on from generation to generation, because Jesus, God did not want Jesus to have this offspring's polluted DNA.
Yes, yes. I think it would be a good transition point here, and I just want to recap. We see in Genesis 6:4 that that the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, that is, in the days of Noah, and also afterward. And we see in Numbers 13, verse 33, the afterward clearly refers to a second and more restrictive eruption of fallen angels producing the hybridization of the various giants, the Anakim, the Emim, the Zumim, the Zamzumim, the various different first, second, third generation giants that were already in the land of Canaan prior to the children of Israel coming in to dispossess them. And when I say the children of Israel, this is the seed of Abraham. And so it's interesting that the enemy had positioned himself in a more restrictive way also afterward, it says in Genesis 6:4. And now the target is the same seed of the woman, but now it's the seed of Abraham as they are coming in to occupy the land. So there are at least two. And here's the interesting thing. There's no record that the children of Israel fully wiped out all the Canaanites. You read the book of Judges, it's clear they didn't. They did not fully wipe out. So there could be some recessive genes. It's not like a first-generation angelic non-generation to a woman, but there are probably traces of that throughout history. Now, G.H. Pember in his book, Earth or Early Stages, which was the first copies released in 1876, he said this: there will be three eruptions, Genesis 6, and of course what happened in the land of Canaan, and then there will be a third and final eruption just prior to the return of the Son of Man. And he said, of all the signs of the Lord's coming, this is going to be the most horrific, that the Nephilim will be on the earth again prior to the return of the Son of Man. This was released by George Hopkins Pember in his book, Earth's Early Stages, in 1876. It's like a prophetic word that he gave way back then. Of course, since then, we've had other writers like I.D. Thomas on the Omega Conspiracy, Satan's Final Assault on the Kingdom of God, where he has done a tremendous job of documenting the present UFO phenomenon and how that is setting us up for the final deception. But this third and final incursion of fallen angels, as it was in the days of Noah, so will be at the return of the Son of Man. This is where, Preston, I want us to go to the book of Daniel, because I think we have a very clear indication here of that which is a prophecy of the third and final eruption. So if you have any comments on what I just said before we turn to Daniel 2.
Yes, I think that if you consistently look at just before the flood, it often relates to the end times. There is an exact parallel. You said that a man worships the sun And of course, in Egypt, worship, they worship the sun. I've been in Egypt, and in Egypt, they have the obelisk. The obelisk is the symbol of worshiping to the sun. You see them throughout Egypt. But we have, there is an obelisk in the square of Moscow. There is an obelisk with Egyptian writing on it in the courtyard of the Vatican.
Yep.
And there is an obelisk in the capital of Washington, D.C., the Washington Monument. If you look at the original, so my question is, what are these three major powers in the world doing with an obelisk here in these last days that worships the sun god? And I think this, the stage is set that we're worshiping things other than the Lord Jesus Christ. If anybody doubts that the Washington Monument is dedicated to the sun god, Robert Mills was the initial architect, and the original base was to have all of the major Roman gods in statuesque form at the base of the Washington Monument. The problem is Washington ran out of money. Washington, D.C., the government ran out of money, so they just cut those Roman gods out, and they just left it as the obelisk, which is the sun god. So we see we have strayed from God, just like the people in the days of Noah strayed from God. And we see the laws in our country. We no longer do what's on our coins in God we trust. So
yes,
that leads us to Daniel, and which is the prophetic book pointing to the last days.
Yes, just a couple of references for our listeners. Chris Pinto and his works, he's done three different works on the occult architecture in Washington, D.C., and the obelisk there. You can just type in Chris Pinto and in Google and put in videos, and you can see some of his works. In fact, Chris Pinto wrote an extended introduction to Tom Horn's latest book, Apollyon Rising. And Tom Horn really unravels the whole history and meaning of the occult architecture and symbolism that we see in Washington, D.C. So that's something that people can pursue if they want to. But it's important, as we turn to the book of Daniel, for to remind our listeners, is that the foundation, the prophetic foundation for understanding the book of Revelation, the actual key to understanding the book of Revelation is the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel is like a precursor, the prophetic foundation for what unfolds in the book of Revelation. And so the two books should actually be taught together in any kind of systematic study. But we're not going to be able to spend the whole time with this tremendous chapter. But we know that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and his magicians and his wise men, he, and of course, Daniel and his three companions were a part of the court. The king demanded that something very unique, that they not only tell the king the dream, but its interpretation. Now, it's one thing to go ahead and tell the magicians the dream, and they could come up with, you know, some kind of interpretation, but this was unheard of. The Nebuchadnezzar says, I not only want the interpretation, I want you to tell me what I dream. Well, that's completely impossible. So God, in order to preserve their lives, there was a sentence of death upon them, God revealed this mystery, this secret to Daniel. And Daniel then came back to Nebuchadnezzar and told him his dream, and then its interpretation. So we know the dream is like a huge statue that represents, from Daniel's time, the world powers. You have Babylon, the head, and you have Media, Persia, that is the silver and the arms and the chest, and then you have the waste, which is the Seleucid Empire, the Grecian Empire under Alexander the Great, and then you have the iron legs that split into two different kingdoms. You have the eastern part of the Roman Empire and the western part, and that's the iron, and then it extends down to its eschatological or end time configuration. It would be Rome II, or the revived Roman Empire. So we see this colossal statue representing the world empires that, of course, oppose God and his people from Daniel's time all the way to the second coming of Christ. And so that's just kind of a summary of the dream and its interpretation. And so I'm going to pick up in Daniel 2:36, and I want us to move into that section that actually prophesies a third and final eruption of fallen angels producing a hybrid race in the end times. Daniel 2:36, this was the dream. Now we shall tell its interpretation before the king. Then Daniel 2:37. By the way, from Daniel 2, verse 4, to Daniel 7, it is the language of Babylon. It is all in Aramaic. And so this is like the times of the Gentiles. The Aramaic is a cognate or a language related to Hebrew, but it has some differences in the way it structures. So this is all in Aramaic, the language of Babylon. He says, "You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand, and he has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. And after you, there will be arise another kingdom inferior to you. That would be Media Persia. Then another kingdom, third kingdom of bronze. That would be the kingdom of Alexander the Great, which will rule over all the earth. Then there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron." In Daniel 2, we see these four empires as man views them. But in Daniel 7, we're given the view of what these kingdoms represent as God sees them, and they're presented as four wild beasts: lion, bear, leopard, and a ravenous beast of iron. Now, why iron? Iron, of course, is something that is man-made. It comes from the earth. It is an ore, but it is used for weapons. And so iron is used throughout the Bible is for weapons. In a figurative sense, it denotes affliction, as we see in Deuteronomy 4:20, in 1 Kings 8:51, and Jeremiah 11:4. Iron also refers to the children of Israel, their slavery in Egypt, Deuteronomy, it's the judgment of God. It represents a slavery and judgment that comes upon the people of God because of idolatry, and Deuteronomy 28:48 and Jeremiah 28:14. It also represents barrenness, Deuteronomy 28:23, and of course it represents obstinacy in Isaiah 48:4. So iron is used in an interesting way here of something that is very strong, and in contrast, as we're going to see, mankind in his natural state. So the fourth kingdom is as strong as iron. This is verse 40. "Inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces." That is the previous kingdoms. "And in that you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron." So we see there's a mixture there. "It will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay." Now the word divided, peleg, is always used. It always signifies unnatural or violent division arising from inner discord or disharmony, such as when the earth was divided in Genesis 10:25, We see how it's used in Psalm 410 and Job 38:25. So, in other words, this kingdom has a weakness. It's the kingdom of Antichrist, and it's going to be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron in as much as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. Now, this word mixed occurs here in verse 41 in the Aramaic, which is Arav. Now, it's used here, and it's also used three times in verse 43. And we're going to have to see the significance of this as it relates to the final third eruption of fallen angels that Pember spoke about in Earth's earliest ages. Then Daniel goes on, interpreting the dream in Daniel 2:42, and as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery. Pottery is man-made. It's something that the man creates, you see. So some of the kingdom will be strong, and part of it will be brittle, that is, capable of being shattered or broken. Now, here is an amazing verse. Now, listen to this. And in that you saw the iron mixed. Mixed. It's very interesting. This same word is used in Ezra 9:2 for mixed marriages. It's also used in Nehemiah 13 for the mixed rabble or mixed multitude that was there threatening the purity of the race of Israel. We see that they had to break up the marriages. Nehemiah caused those mixed marriages to be dissolved for this very thing, to maintain the purity of that seed. So again, we have the word mixed. It refers to that which is a result of marriages. Now, we have various kings of the earth that are involved in producing women that are given over to angels so these women can be prepared through specific kinds of rituals to conceive and give birth to Nephilim. So this is ultimately what I believe we're referring to here. In that you saw the iron mix, that is, through intermarriage with common clay. Notice, common clay, what is that? Adamic. They will combine, again, the same word used, combine through mixed marriage, through intermarriage, with one another in the seed of men. Notice, they. Who are they? Who are they? Well, we say, are those the toes? I believe that's an indirect reference to the third and final eruption of fallen angels. Just as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be at the return of the Son of Man. They will combine with one another through mixed marriage, again the same word, with, notice, the seed of men. So what seed is going to combine with the seed of men? That takes us right back to Genesis 6. But they will not adhere, davak. The word davak is used in Genesis 2:4 of Adam cleaving in love and loyalty and affection to his wife. It's also used throughout the Old Testament passages of the relationship that God intended between God and man. Like in Deuteronomy 7:7, Deuteronomy 10:15, it's to cling to him in loyalty and love. So here, this davak, they would cling to one another. The design between the fallen angels, again, in this third and final eruption, would cleave to these women, just like we see the same word used in Genesis 2:24, but they will not adhere. They will not cleave to one another, even as iron does not combine, again, the same word, with pottery. And so here we have a very clear reference to the third and final incursion of that which represents Satan's final conspiracy against mankind, against the people of God, and that which will culminate in Armageddon. I want to check with George Ann to give us the time, if she would, please.
1 hour and 19 minutes.
Would this be a good time to break for a part two?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
You've been listening to Douglas Riggs and Dr. Preston Bailey, and we will be moving on to part two.